All right. Well, it's my pleasure to introduce Kevin Griffin. I'm excited to hear a little bit more about your story. Take it away, Kevin.
Thanks,
Thanks for being
Jim.
here.
Thanks, Mark, for inviting me. I am in Berkeley, California, where I reside, where my life has led me after a twist or two, turn and two. I guess I was invited because I'm a writer who writes about recovery, and the connection started really connecting Buddhism and the 12 steps. And I published a book in 2004 called One Breath at a Time. And then I've done kind of a series on that topic. I keep spitting them out. One of them is about how to navigate the higher power idea. And there's one about this kind of a workbook and a daily reflections book. But that's somewhere that I arrived at after obviously a long journey. And I guess maybe to talk a little bit about my alcoholism and addiction, which I don't think I mentioned. My name's Kevin, and I'm an alcoholic and an addict. I mean, it's funny. I've been sober now for 37 years. I'll be 38 in June. I don't count days, but it's fun to hear people count the days. And it's getting harder actually for me to talk about the time before I got sober. Partly because it just seems so far away. But I also think there is a way in which those wounds don't necessarily go away, and I don't love thinking about things I did. That's interesting. You'd think you'd get over it. What is it? There's a saying, I've heard it from Jack Kornfield. Forgiveness is giving up any hope for a better past. And so I guess I haven't completely forgiven myself, perhaps. I was talking to my brother, my next older brother, yesterday because it was his daughter's birthday. And his daughter is 12. He became a father for the first time when he was 64. Well, we have an unusual family. But he taught me how to drink, Michael. And I started drinking when I was 16, and immediately I drank alcoholically. I dropped out of school soon after. Because I was busy getting loaded and becoming a rock and roll star. And really my worst drinking was probably in the first 5 or 6 years. I mean, in those days, I would drink to black out and take drugs and almost kill myself repeatedly. And then I started to manage it all, which is really dangerous, right? In my 20s, I only periodically blacked out or got sick. The rest of the time it was all very much under control. Ha ha ha. And I stayed high. Marijuana was in a lot of ways my drug of choice, and I think it was not only in a way my drug of choice, but the one that I took pride in. I didn't take pride in being an alcoholic, but I took pride in smoking dope all the time because it was like cool or something. I don't know what the fuck it was. It was like, I'm a hippie, so that's what I do. And I'm a rebel, and I'm a antisocial, or I'm a countercultural person, or all these sort of delusions that one carries in order to justify just staying loaded and not really doing anything with your life, you know, just living in a sort of fantasy. The fantasy for me was I'm going to be a rock star, you know, but never really doing anything about it. I mean, playing in bars for, you know, $15 a night wasn't exactly the path to fame and fortune. You have to do more than that. But I will say that along with that not so constructive, delusional and addictive aspect of my life, there was also always a spiritual path, a spiritual side to me. And I see that I started to realize, particularly when I started to teach and tell my story, that there were a lot of people, a lot of recovering addicts had something like that, we say I'm an alcoholic or I'm an addict, and it's like it's supposed to define you maybe, and I think that maybe people, you know, who hear that assume that just means that's all you ever did, but of course that's not all we ever did. A lot of us had other things going on in our lives, and one of them was often some kind of a spiritual yearning. And, you know, and there is, you know, the 12-step literature and other literature talks about how addiction is is an expression, like a misguided spiritual search. And the, you know, the connection between the word spirits for alcohol and spirit for and spiritual is the thing that people point to. I mean, and we even see in religious rituals, you know, growing up Catholic, as certainly that some of you presumably have, you know, that's right there in the middle of the mass is wine. And of course, nowadays, everybody thinks that, you know, ayahuasca is the way to God. Good luck with that. So there was this, how I view it now is that there was this tension, right, between this part of me that wanted transcendence, wanted spiritual purpose and meaning in my life, and wanted to be a constructive and a good person, you know, to do something positive. And this part of me that couldn't. Is the easiest way to put it. Like, it just couldn't deal, couldn't handle feelings, couldn't restrain my cravings, limit my, acting out and selfish behavior. And a lot of that was around, relationships, or, you know, if you want to call them relationships, you know, sexual acting out. So, you know, eventually, before I got sober, I discovered Buddhism, and I thought, oh, this is going to fix me. You know, it's going to take care of me. Because part of my story, a significant part of my story, is that I was a depressive. Before I even started to drink at 16, I was already seeing a psychiatrist. I mean, and treated for depression, and at one point hospitalized when I was 18. So I thought, oh, I'll meditate, you know, and that'll take away my depression, and somehow it's going to fix everything, and I'll get enlightened, you know, and you know, there was a part of me that was very determined, you know. I mean, I did some very intensive meditation retreats at that point, but they didn't fix me. And so I went off, and I wound up like following a homeless guru, which was truly delusion, and wound up homeless myself after I realized like I couldn't really hang with the homeless guru. And so 3 years before I got sober is when I really hit my bottom, which was living, you know, in a VW, I was sleeping in a VW bus. I wasn't living in it because my friend needed it for to go to work in the morning. So sleeping in a VW bus in Venice Beach, California, and you know, trying to figure out what the fuck happened to me, what I was doing there. In any case, I dug myself out of that over the course of a few years, and eventually, you know, but through the prodding of others, I thought, out of desperation, which why else, I went to Alcoholics Anonymous. I went to an AA meeting, and it wasn't even so much going to an AA meeting. It was saying, you know, maybe if I stop drinking and getting loaded, maybe that'll fix me. You know, again, it was always about a fix. You know, I don't know if you can hear the dog, but she's the neighbor's dog is barking. That's Olive, for those who have not met her. Some of you have. And but something happened, and it's still, you know, and this is the one of the things that you hear so much in AA, and the people take on as a kind of religious thing, which is like, how the hell did that happen? Like, how did I like turn that corner and like one day, like, no, I'm not drinking anymore. I'm not smoking dope anymore. I'm not taking drugs. You know, it was removed. The desire was removed. I woke up June 7th, 1985, and I was like, oh, I'm not going to do that anymore. And there was some change that happened. I that for me, if there's a spiritual awakening, that was the biggest one, because everything that's happened in my life, everything good that's happened in my life in these years came out of that moment. And so, you know, like a lot of people, I kind of went through this reconstructing of my life and, you know, went back to school. You know, as I said, I dropped out of high school, went back to school, discovered that I loved studying, discovered that I loved reading and I loved writing, which I had never done. I had written songs, but they were kind of like stoner songs. You know, became this different person who wasn't like cool anymore. You know, I had like a job and like got up in the morning and you know, try to behave in a moral way. And I started to feel happy, really, for the first time in my life. Like happy, not like in a good mood all the time, but happy like my life makes sense. And it seems worth living, and I don't need to be fixed. So I guess, though, the thing that makes my story, you know, a little different is that, you know, I had this Buddhist background. And so when I got sober and there was like this 11 step where that you were supposed to meditate, I thought, oh, okay, that's great. These people meditate. And then I found out like hardly anybody really did. And I was like, well, what? Why is that? Like, what's going on? And so eventually, at like 6 or 7 years sober, I started to really try to integrate my Buddhist practice with my 12-step work and figure out how to make that make sense. And that took a long time to do that in a way. I mean, in a way, it was, it's kind of contradict myself. In a way, it was like, oh, sure, why not? Of course, those can go together. But in terms of actually the details of that, like, well, how do you work this step with Buddhism? That took a long time. And before that happened, I was invited into a teacher training, so as a meditation teacher. And so I was starting to take this role as a teacher. And then as soon as I started teaching, like, recovery stuff started to come out of my mouth, and I was embarrassed, actually. You know, I thought that all the Buddhists in Berkeley would be horrified by the idea of a of somebody, an addict, talking about recovery in their Buddhist group. But actually, it turned out there were a bunch of sober people hanging out who, you know, undercover, right, in the Buddhist world. And they started to encourage me to talk more about it. So, you know, and so there was my path, you know. And it's just so interesting because all these things that seemed disconnected and just seemed like random things that happened in my life kind of all merged at this moment in time. In 2003, you know, I got laid off from a job and got unemployment. And my wife said, why don't you consider it a sabbatical and start to write your book about Buddhism and the 12 steps? And so I had, in having gone back to school, I had started writing and had tried to write fiction. I had got a master's in creative writing. So I had that muscle, that's somewhat of a skill there. I had been practicing Buddhist meditation then for over 20 years. I'd been sober for a decade and a half, more than that, 18 years. And I started to write, and it all seemed to be there. And that was really, really fun, actually. You know, people talk about, oh, it's so hard to write a book. I love writing. I mean, it's not always good. You know, I'll just spit it out, you know. I always say it's just like picking up a guitar. I don't like get guitar block when I pick up my guitar. I just play, and writing is mostly the same. Sometimes I get stuck, but there was this joyful thing of writing. And you know, whereas many of other ambitious things I had done in my life, in the music world and writing novels that never got published, I would keep hitting walls, and you know, the world just didn't want me to be those things. This idea and this book immediately found an agent, immediately found a publisher, and immediately started to sell. And I was like, what? People like that? People are interested? Because I kind of wrote it for myself, you know? I didn't really think, oh, yeah, I'm gonna become a Buddhist recovery author and I'll be famous and talk to people in Ireland, you know? I was like, it wasn't in my mind, you know, which is good, right? You know, because a lot of other things, you know, being a rock, when I was a kid and I wanted to be a rock star, there was a lot of ego behind that. It's never seemed like really the cool thing to be like, I'll be a Buddhist recovery author. Like, who gives a shit? Like, that's just like not particularly sexy. But I'm too old to be sexy anymore anyway, so why bother? So there you go. I mean, that's kind of the story. You know, I've been doing this for 20 years because once that book came out, people started to bother me and tell me they wanted me to come around and teach them something. You know, and I'm working on a book right now. It's not a recovery book. It's a Buddhist book. And it's really the deepest dive into meditation that I've written. And it's really humbling. It's really humbling to look at the Buddhist teachings and try to talk about them and then realize how much you don't understand, you know. You know, I was speaking to one of my teachers last summer. I was in England visiting the monastery where he's the abbot. And I told him about what I was writing. And I said, I really don't know if I should try to publish this book. You know, it's just really a struggle trying to talk about these things. And he said, that's what people like about you, is that you expose your struggle. And so I guess I have to do that. And that's what I like about this world of recovery, that we expose our struggle. You know, it was the attempt to not let anybody see how fucked up I was that was so painful. When I was able to go to a meeting and say, I'm an alcoholic, I find that freeing, you know, and it's interesting because I know a lot of people, and particularly, you know, people who don't want to get sober or don't want to deal with it, are like, oh, you know, I don't want to put myself in that box, or I don't want to label myself. And fair, you know, fair enough. I can understand why you'd say that, but it's not how it works for me. That was the thing that let me break out of my box. You know, I was trapped in my own box of ego and fear and self-protection and, you know, needing to feel as if, I don't know, I didn't feel as if I had it together, but like I couldn't let anybody else know or whatever it was. I don't know. It's confusing to understand, you know, why we do what we do. I was in a band a long time ago with the Nigerian sax and conga player, and he wrote beautiful songs. One of his songs was called Shabadoodai, which is like, and there was a line in it that just was like, why do we do what we do? How do we do what we do? And he doesn't try to answer it. He just says Shabadoodai. It's like, okay, that explains it. Why do we do what we do? Shabadoodai. And yeah, but I think I feel like being sober, clean and sober, I do know why I do things, you know, and it's a lot better than not knowing why the hell I'm doing things. So I guess I'll just share a little bit of what I'm doing currently. If people are interested, you can just, if you're interested in what I do and my books or my teaching, I have a website and, you know, I'm not here to market myself, but, you know, I know that people might be interested. So if you're interested, I will put my website in the chat. Oh, can you enable the chat for me there, Jim? Or you can just put my website in the chat. All right, great. Thank you. And I do regular Zoom classes where I guide meditation for 20 minutes and then give a little talk. And I do that every Tuesday morning. It's 10 a.m. in Berkeley, so after Pacific time. And then in the evenings on Fridays, 7 p.m. And those are just drop-in. You can come, can donate if you want. You don't have to. And I do lots of other things. I travel and teach. And hopefully I'm going to be in Ireland later this year. I was there last summer. Gave a workshop for the Mindfulness Teachers Association of Ireland. So come around, come and visit me, come hang out. A couple of my friends who are regulars are here today, and we've been having a nice time these last few years. Zoom has been a lifesaver. I think that's going to be it for now. Jim said maybe we could just, if people were interested, they could ask questions. If people aren't interested, then you can do whatever you want to do, talk about whatever you want to do. I don't want to, but yeah, I mean, if people are interested in meditation or what I do or any connections, like how I do it, I'm happy to respond to any questions.
Perfect. Thank you, Kevin. That was great. We'll, We use the raise hand features here. We're going to leave the recording going for the questions or comments. And if you do not want to be recorded, the chat's back open. You can always put questions in the chat and I can ask them. I had a quick one, Kevin. I was curious if the process of writing that first book, you know, how it affected or might have changed both your Buddhism practice or your recovery or both, if that process was enlightening in any way.
Yeah, that's a great question, Jimmy. So I write as a creative exercise. So I don't go into any writing project with a sense that I'm just like downloading everything that's all in my head. It's more like what's in my heart and what's in my head and my heart that I can share. What can I discover? So it was quite remarkable for me writing that book because I learned a lot. there were a lot of things I had not really thought through because I hadn't had to, you know, and so each time I came to one of those 12 steps, I would ask myself, well, what does this mean? And how can I connect Buddhism to this? And I wanted to bring out a lot of kind of core Buddhist teachings, the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, and various lists and sort of ideas. And I wanted to integrate them in. And so I was always kind of trying to navigate, well, where does this list fit into the steps? And then how can I help people to understand what this step means? Because I was trying to make it so that somebody in recovery who didn't know about Buddhism could learn about Buddhism and find, and if especially if they had trouble with God, that they could kind of find a way to work the steps using Buddhist principles. But I was also trying to talk to Buddhists and say, see how these 12-step ideas actually like fit with Buddhism and actually can help Buddhism. Like, it's not a one-way street for me. And most people think it is, you know, that I'm just trying to get the 12-step people to understand Buddhism or to connect with that. But I think there's a lot of people who not even necessarily addicts who could really benefit, who have a Buddhist practice, but who could benefit from principles of recovery that are implied in Buddhism, but aren't necessarily, you know, fully integrated into Western Buddhism. So it was a real adventure and discovery process, as it continues to be. I mean, I writing one book didn't end my process. You know, it's a continual one of discovery for me. But thanks.
Awesome. Thank you. Sarah, please come on in. Oh, let me make sure you can unmute. You should be able to unmute now.
Okay, thank you. Virtual intervention, I guess. All right. I just very briefly wanted to say that I have been sober for 12 days now, although it is my second experience at the attempt. First time I lacked the spirituality, and the second time I found my spirituality, which is why it's a brand new start for me. Kevin, I must say I've heard a lot of, I've been to Zoom meetings every day, sometimes two meetings a day, like I had a previous one before this one. But I must say so far, you are just the most powerful share I have ever heard. And mostly what your humility, you're a very, very humble person, you know, and that's very refreshing. It's very refreshing. So kudos to you. I have been a teacher for 33 years, so I can relate to that. I have just currently, I suffer from CPTSD, which is complex PTSD, and I am tackling my trauma stemming from my childhood. I'm 67 years old and I'm working with that. And my sponsor, who's from Florida, is a sick woman. But I recently decided, one great change I decided change the things we can is to stop teaching. That's it. I've had enough of this. And I have all the support of my husband. I have all the support of my husband. We're now a little bit on a tighter budget, obviously, because there is one pay less, but God take care of that. I mean, I'm praying hard, and this is one thing I find most difficult as I go along, is to trust my God as I know him, my higher power, 100%. I mean, we are such control freaks. We're such control freaks, and it's so difficult to say, you know, let go and let God, trust my higher power 100%, totally relinquishing control of any situation. I mean, one of the prayers, third step prayer, I think, take it easy and relax. So my partner, he's an atheist, my husband, he's in Australia, and he's utterly astonished. He was having a little bit of a panic attack at the airport. He traveled to Italy a little bit. Holiday. Anyway, I have a shoestring budget, but anyway. And he got into a bit of a panic at the airport coming back, because when we went into the airport, Catania Airport, he couldn't access Wi-Fi. He had to access Wi-Fi on his phone because the boarding passes were on his phone. And he was running around like a headless chicken trying to sort that out. And then he came to the cafeteria downstairs, and he found me, you know, relaxed at the coffee table, bar table. I was having, this is 8 o'clock in the morning, please note. I was having a typical Sicilian cannolo, a sweet with a cappuccino. And he just stopped dead in his tracks. And he said, "What the fuck, woman?" He said, "You know, what you have to do for me is," he says to me, "relax and take it easy, leave it all in my hands." Sure enough, 5 minutes later, we got his internet, and we checked it, we got the scanner code on the whatever on the mobile, and we boarded the system. So anyway, I think I've taken up more than enough time for other people to speak. I hope something of what I said is useful. Kevin, I will follow up your book, One Breath at a Time. And I took down a note of your website, and I'm inspired. Seriously, I'm inspired.
Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thanks, Sarah. Pearl, please come on in. Good to see you.
Thanks very much. And thank you, Kevin. It was great listening to you. And as I mentioned there, the rawness of a day at a time, you know, it is there all the time, you know, and like yourself, I have a good bit of mileage around, and one of the things you mentioned about, you know, the hippie days and being cool and doing, I wish I'd stayed with it. but the alcohol was always the one drug of choice, you know, but I got into a lot less difficulty when I was, you know, it was cooler to be doing the more hippie side of it and the smokes than what the alcohol brought, you know. The alcohol just took me to my knees time and time again, you know. And the journey, you know, into spirituality and into, I went to TM. And like yourself, I was very troubled all the way down to schools and all that stuff, you know. But I went to TM at once before I stopped drinking, you know, because I had a hunger in my soul and I knew it, like I had an emptiness in me that I knew nothing and a material ever could fill, you know. And that's what I felt from you, you know, it was just that thirst for what, like, you know. And I saw somebody describe it as hide and seek. You know, you might get a glimpse of something and then it's gone again, you know, but you just knew there was something there. And even as a child, I knew there was something there, you know. And you just woke it up in me, you know. There was a storybook I discovered there was no Santi because I found this storybook when I was a child. And it was a child, an angel polishing a star. I'd forgotten completely about it. And what did I want to do? I wanted to polish my star and for the star to be the one. But I was never good enough. And then it turned out for some reason, none of the other stars could turn up. And mine was chosen at the end of the day, you know. And I'm a bit like that all the time. I'm a serious astrologer in Vedic astrology. And I suppose Hindu would be more if I was to, you know, because of the language of it. But, you know, I go to any and all, you know, sources now. I'm not secular, you know, I know I'm not. Like, my heart is totally in the concept of divinity, you know. But I just came, my current passion is to get in touch with Irish wisdom and the depth of it that's there. And just something I came across very recently is, now I've known about it, but never joined the dots. One of the names for Ireland is the Emerald Isle. I don't know if you've ever heard.
Sure, of course.
But there's an emerald tablet.
Ah.
Now.
Interesting.
And nobody has claimed it yet, you know, whether it is Egyptian or Greek or, you know, they all know of it. Hermes and, well, they all know of this energy, but I reckon we're the closest to having a claim. Going back the way, you know, because there is some amazing, and even 100 years ago in Ireland, there were people who were, you know, the Theosophical Society and Helena Blavatsky are very much involved in the Buddhist community. And, you know, they were, so their writings and writings from that time are very rich as well, you know. So if you do come to Ireland, I'd love to meet you.
All right.
I live in Galway. I don't know where you're coming. But
yeah, we spent 2 weeks in Galway last summer.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Because my son is actually teaching the Buddhism now as well. He's mindfulness.
Oh yeah.
With the company that he's working with.
Oh, very good. Yeah.
And so maybe you met him. I don't know.
Yeah.
But anyway, yeah, I'd be delighted to meet you if you do come this way. And we can have a chat. But the recovery journey is just amazing. And I'd say for, like, there's quite a few people here, and I don't mean to go on, but, like, more gets revealed. That's promised, you know. Yeah. And it's not like we arrive someplace. As I say, it's like a game of hide and seek. Now you see it, now you don't. Right. You know, today it's there and then tomorrow it's gone, or half an hour later it's gone, or, you know, something happens. But it's wonderful, you know, to hear it, you know, and to see and what you've done and, you know, all the writing. I've done a lot of writing myself as well. Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Thanks.
Mark told me I'd like this one.
Very good. An astrologer told me when I was, I was about 31, 30, that I was going to be a writer. And it was like a thorough chart, you know, in the traditional astrology. And I was like, well, I'm a songwriter. And she was like, no, not a songwriter. You're going to be. And I was like, I don't know what you're talking about. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's a good map. It's a useful map. It's not the be all and the end all, but it's useful.
It's not really, the predicting part of it isn't really the most useful part. To me, it's the more the kind of framing personality and understanding the nuances and sort of contradictions in ourselves.
Yeah, the self-examination of the 11th step is what I would equate it with. You know, it asks for that. We need to do that. And the step one, you know, the step one is primary. if you have no appreciation of yourself, then nothing else can work. So we have to take the first.
That's and, for sure.
You know, everything else is a bonus. So thank you.
Thanks, bro.
Yeah, love to meet you. Thank you. Pleasure.
Thanks, Monica. Hi, good to see you. Come on in.
Good to see you. I'll be at next Tuesday's meeting in Santa Rosa. Good evening or good day, everybody. Monica, alcoholic and spiritual fence sitter. Glad to be here. Thanks for helping keep me sober today. This is an amazing thing. As soon as I heard that our guest speaker was going to be doing the meeting tonight, I was so pleased. My story is my current sobriety date is Cinco de Mayo, 2021. Did that on purpose so I can remember the special day and drink irresponsibly with non-alcoholic beverages. But nonetheless, my story is I've been in and out of the rooms of AA since 2007, starting where I lived in Tucson, Arizona. And I did my first 90 meetings in 90 days, white-knuckled it, had to be on psychiatric medications trying to get my mental act together. But in 2008, I went back to my same home group that I became frustrated with. And there was a young crazy paramedic in our group at that time. And he and I used to have parking lot discussions or the meetings after the meetings that we referred to, at least in America. But anyway, nonetheless, he gave me your book and I completely read the book in 2008. Long story short, I ended up finally trying to get my shit together or my act together, excuse my French, in 2021. And one of the key things was we were blessed with this damn pandemic. I'm saying that ironically because it created the forum of Zoom meetings and allowed me to look into secular AA. And that's one of the most important parts of my recovery journey today and helping keep me sober. But I practice recovery dharma. I read from the book Recovery Dharma. And I truly do feel as an agnostic by nature that if I was going to practice any type of religious affiliation, it would be Buddhism. And so I just encourage everybody here, if you can and you want to have recovery dharma be part of your journey, it's well worth it. And if nothing else, you'll learn how to breathe and you'll learn how to meditate and you'll learn how to have a much better life. Thanks for letting me share today.
Thank you.
Thanks, Monica. Joe, hey, good to see you. Come on in.
You too, Jim. Thanks for hosting today. Kevin, thanks for being here and speaking to our group today. I appreciate it. I've been sober just a little over 15 years, and I too I took my refuge vows into Buddhism in 99, thinking that I'd be able to make sense of everything. And ironically, I discovered that if I slept in an hour later and skipped meditation, then I could drink more the night before. So my meditation really took a backseat for a few years there until I got sober some years later. And then in 2012, I took my bodhisattva vows. But anyways, my question to you is, I was wondering if you could briefly discuss steps 2 and 3 from your perspective.
Briefly?
Well, I mean...
No, I'm happy to. I'm just laughing because I wrote a book basically. So.
And I read your book. I did, but I don't have it memorized. And I just thought to hear
I know.
Straight from you would be fascinating.
Thank you. So, I mean, in a way... I like to just even remove the God idea from the steps, at least for a moment, to see if there's another way of viewing them as a process that doesn't involve some, you know, external power. So if I do that, step 2 is about believing or trusting in two things, that there is a way to recover, that it's a realistic goal, and believing that I'm capable of doing it. Because if I don't believe those two things, then I'm not even going to be able to engage in the process. If I think, oh, you can't, there's no way, or I don't, or, you know, this program, I don't believe in this program or that program. You know, this is one of the things people will be like, well, you know, oh, that doesn't work. Well, this doesn't work. Well, this doesn't work, right? Just pointing at all the external things. Well, it doesn't work. Then nothing's going to happen if I don't believe that there's a process. And then if I don't believe I can do it, because I might say, oh yeah, that works for some people, but it won't work for me. So I have to believe that I can do it, and I have to believe that there is a way. And that's true of Buddhism as well, right? Because if you don't believe in the path of Buddhism, you're not going to engage it. You might believe that Buddhism is a great path, but that you can't meditate. I've had people say, oh, I can't meditate. You know, okay, fine. Then you won't if you believe that, right? So we can see how belief, and traditionally that's sometimes called faith, but in Buddhism, we don't really think of it as faith. It's more like trust or confidence. The dog is really on a roll this morning. Anyway, and which I find annoying, just to let you know. As a Buddhist, I can still get annoyed. So the third step then is the beginning of the engagement in that path. Deciding to step out of my own, you know, desire-driven, ego-driven view and motivation in life. So why am I doing things? Why do I do something? Well, typically I do something because I want to do it, right? So that's ego, that's grasping, right? That's craving, which we know in Buddhist teachings, those are all the things that cause suffering. If you're acting out of grasping, you're creating suffering for yourself. So the step three is saying, don't do things based on self, on ego, on grasping. Try to be led by some higher principles, or let's put it, not even higher. I don't even really like higher, wiser principles. So Buddhism gives me a model for that, a path for that, the Eightfold Path. When I turn my will and my life over, what I'm doing is I'm saying that instead of letting my will or my intention be driven by grasping and ego gratification, seeking ego satisfaction, I'm going to try to be led and guided by these principles. And I'm going to try to then act on them. So my will is my intention in Buddhist terms, like what's the motivation. And my life is the actions that I take. So this is the engagement in the path that happens here. That engagement traditionally has three levels: the level of ethical, behavioral engagement, which is the foundation of recovery. It's what we mostly deal with in recovery. Then the level of the mental engagement, the meditative engagement, the mental purification, the observing the mind, letting go of the negative energy. Negative, I don't love that term either. Letting go of the unwholesome, cultivating the wholesome. And then the insight, wisdom, being guided by the wisdom of the Dharma and the teachings and the wisdom that comes out of our own hearts as we cultivate these qualities, as we live an ethical, morally based life, and one that's founded in awareness. So that's my shorthand for steps two and three. Okay.
Awesome. Thanks for that, Kevin. That was great.
I mean, that's a whole lot. So it's good that it's recorded, because if somebody wanted, like, was starting from nowhere and didn't know anything about this, they might want to listen to that part for about 10 times to figure out what the hell I was saying.
I have a quick follow-up question to that, that it may be splitting hairs, but do you think that you're turning your life and your will over to these principles, or that you're directing your thinking and action towards these principles? Maybe they're the same thing. I don't really know, but there's that phrase that's often used, that my best thinking got me here, that I sort of personally think of it as my worst thinking got me here. My best thinking was deciding to come here and do something about my life and the way I've been acting, and sort of in that way of thinking. I might be getting hung up on it, but I'm just curious if you have any thoughts about that, if that makes any sense.
So I'm not sure. The first way you phrased that, I thought you were asking about free will, kind of.
Yeah, I think so. Yes.
Which is always a challenging question, and one that philosophers have spent a lot of time on. And I'm not a philosopher at all. Because you can make an argument based on spiritual principles that we don't have free will. However, the core principle of Buddhist practice is that we create our own karma through our thoughts, words, and actions. So, you know, but because everything is conditioned, you can make this argument that, well, those thoughts, words, and actions are all conditioned, so it's not really free. I find that an unproductive exercise in analyzing it, because, well, it doesn't solve anything. I'm interested in solutions. So what I can see is that whether it's conditioned or not, in this moment, I'm having a thought, I'm saying something, I'm doing something, and those things right now are the only, you know, what I do with those things are the only things that I can do to influence my life going forward. And being responsible in the present moment and doing my best to act wisely, wholesomely, skillfully in this moment, to think wisely, to speak wisely. That's the most important thing I can do. Whether I'm making a choice or whether it's just all conditioned unfolding, I don't know. But it sure feels as if I'm making a choice. And pretty clearly, there have been moments in my life and in each of our lives where we've thought something and done something that then had huge repercussions. And so I don't know if that's at all answering your question.
That was perfect. That was great. I enjoyed hearing that. Thank you. I'm going to listen to it again.
Okay.
There's more hands. Angie, please come on in.
Hi, thanks for the meeting. And thanks, Kevin. I really loved that. I read your book and I understood what you said about pain in it, but is there any further reading you'd recommend for chronic pain and Buddhism?
Oof. Wow. Trying to think of there's a Zen teacher. It's more about death than pain. There's a lot about death in the Buddhist world, but chronic pain is such a tough one, Angie, because, you know, that there are Buddhist teachers who will just say, oh, just be mindful of it. And that doesn't really work in the same way for, you know, with chronic pain as it does with episodic pain. And so it's not Frank. I wish I could think of this author's name. I'll look up one person. I'm thinking of Frank Ostaseski. He has a book. Yeah, I guess it's about death, but I've got to believe that if he's writing about death, he's already also writing about pain. I don't know. So I'm going to put this in the chat. This is called the Five Initiations. I'm sorry, Five Invitations. I haven't read it, but I've heard great things about it. He's a Zen teacher. And so, you know, it might be helpful. I'm sorry, I can't be more helpful than that. Because with episodic pain, a Buddhist teacher will typically say, you know, be mindful of the sensation and let go of your aversion to it, and then work with it, like make your mind spacious and allow the pain to come and go and see how it's impermanent. But when something's really chronic and stays with you, focusing on it can be counterproductive, as you probably know. And so we have to find ways, I think, to protect ourselves from the pain without obviously becoming addicted to drugs. And you know, that's I think a very delicate dance that requires us to at times turn to the sensation, be with it, breathe with it, try to let go of our aversion, but then to turn away from it. And to, I mean, I think what's hardest about chronic pain is not the pain itself, but what it does to our mind and how it wears us down and becomes frustrating and depressing and triggers irritation and irritability that comes with it. So all of that winds up being the real struggle. I do think that meditation can be helpful, but sometimes just sitting in meditation can be, you know, can bring up the pain more. And so it can be better to do something like a Qigong or some kind of gentle movement to work with it. So that's about the best I can offer, Angie.
That's brilliant. Thanks, Kevin.
I'm glad somebody put something in the chat that you might look at. Vidyamala Birch developed mindfulness-based approach to chronic pain. So there you go. Mark, hi. Now I'm calling on people, Jimmy.
That's great, man. Don't worry, Jim is good. Kevin, thank you for coming today, man. Maybe next time you're in Ireland, me, you and Carl will play some golf or something. But I was just curious to know, in your opinion, has online helped you more than in person? Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I heard you.
Yeah, and has it, helped? Sorry, that was the question.
So has it helped me in what sense?
In your recovery, do you think that you wouldn't have done Zoom if it wasn't for, like, the likes of COVID, or were you doing online meetings anyway?
I definitely would not have done it. I was doing some teaching through it. I was part of a teacher training program where I was mentoring people. So I knew about Zoom. I was using Zoom. But I mean, I was saying this to someone the other day, you know, we used to think that doing something online was kind of lame, like not real teaching, you know, and not a real class. Is like a shortcut. But now we realize that it opens up the community allows us to reach people all over the world. And so I find that hugely helpful. And for myself, it also allows me to not have to get on a plane or get in the car all the time. And so I appreciate all that. But nonetheless, it's not, you know, as rich an experience to be online as it is to be in a room with people. There's nothing like that. You know, we definitely lose something in terms of our human connection when it's just online. So I'm really grateful that we had Zoom, because if the pandemic had happened 10 years ago, we would have been so much more isolated, and it would have been just really, it's frightening to even imagine what it would have been like, especially for people in recovery. But for Buddhist communities and many communities, obviously, and businesses, everything. I mean, it just, so as much as we all complain about Zoom, it's saved the world, really, you know, in a way, like no technology has ever saved the world, you know. So there you go. That's what I think. What do you think?
I think it's helped me a lot. Because, yeah, like I can be at a meeting anywhere. Like right now, am I in your house? Or are you in my house? Are we in Jim's house? With the recordings as well, Kevin. Like we can listen back. Yeah, I just want to say thanks for coming today, and thank you for answering my questions. So.
Yeah, thanks, Mark. Hopefully we'll meet soon. Jeb.
Yes, my name is Jeb. Grateful recovered addict, alcoholic, still on the path of recovery, one day at a time. And Kevin, thank you so much for sharing yourself, your story today. And, you know, it's a wonderful example of experience, strength, and hope coming out in self-disclosure of what has worked for one person and for many others. And I appreciate that. And one of the things I'm grateful for is that you seem to have done a good job of connecting the dots between different spiritual processes. I don't want to say religions, because I don't consider the Buddhism that I'm familiar with is not a religion. It's a way of mm-hmm. life. It's a path of,
yeah.
way of life. And that's precisely what the 12 steps are.
Right.
And, you know, I come from a very orthodox Christian background, but then evangelical, charismatic period in my life before I came to AA. And there, you know, I think what I can read the AA literature and just wonder how much exposure Bill Wilson had to Buddhist practices and other Eastern ideas, because they do appear there. And I think one of the most significant ones is the way he stated the first step of recovery was what we conceded to our innermost selves that we were alcoholic. This is the first, and I nabbed up to that originally, because by the time I came to AA, I was a couple of years sober. I'd already realized that looking outside myself for the answers was codependent and ugly, and it was not going to get me anywhere. But the purpose of the steps is to find the power within. So when I read any of that literature, I just substitute the word power all the way through, because it's not an anthropomorphic definition of this deity idea, but a power, a presence, and that I can tap into. And of course, you know, Bill Wilson wrote some really strange things in the 12 and 12 that took us back into them, or that superstitious religious idea. But, you know, still there's some gems that come forward through there. So, yeah. And now my first exposure to Buddhism was when I was working on my second master's degree at the head of the department, and the my advisor was a disciple of Thich Nhat Hanh, He spent much time in Plum Village and so forth. And, you know, so the Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, man, I just said, but boy, I just have to fit them into the 12 steps so that I can get the most out of it. I can have all, you know, all of the actions that I can take if I want to and willing to, so I can have the benefits of the freedom and self-esteem and self-worth and so forth, and quit comparing myself to other people, quit thinking that somebody else is going to do the things that only we can do or I can do. So it's been a really refreshing thing. And even when I was a charismatic Christian, I referred to myself as a hyphenated Christian, because I was already beginning to ingest some of the teachings of the Buddha and really had a concept of the Buddha being within every one of us, not something out there, certainly a historical figure, but something within each one of us, which Bill Wilson referred to the great reality deep within, and later unsuspected inner resource. So that's been the most liberating thing. It's helped me to take power away from all the other things. And I wish I had a question for you, but thanks. But but the things that you're talking about helped to bring me to the point of freedom that I have today. And of course, that's the idea of I'm responsible for my own happiness, joy, and freedom.
Yeah.
But I can't do it alone. I just still need the community.
Yeah.
And this or something else. So yeah, thanks so much.
Thanks, Jim.
It's day 16,287 since my last alcohol.
You reminded me that there's a really interesting pamphlet that Dr. Bob, the co-founder, he didn't write it, but he asked someone to write it. It's called The Spiritual Dimensions of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in it, he says, he talks about different religions, arguing that AA is not a Christian religion. And he says that the Buddha's Noble Eightfold Path could be a substitute for the 12 steps.
Oh, yes.
It's part of what's called the Akron pamphlets, where he was from Akron. And so it's worth checking out. You can get it from the Akron AA community. It definitely opened my mind, because there are people who argue that Dr. Bob was that he believed that you had to be a Christian to get sober or to work the steps, which is pretty ridiculous given the language of the steps.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Jim. So Hugh has his hand up. Hello.
Hello, Kevin. How are you?
All right.
It was interesting listening to you. My first sponsor had a load of books on Buddhism, books by Suzuki, maybe you're familiar with Suzuki.
Yeah.
They take books, and he left them all to me, and I moved house, and I left most of the books behind. Me, I was a bit neurotic, and he left me a Krishnamurti book. She said, if you read this book, you never need another book again. And there's a friend of mine, he's not in the fellowship, but he swears by Krishnamurti, and I think I introduced him to it. And I didn't think of it at the time, but I felt like saying, you know, Krishnamurti is fine, but the icing on the cake really is Sri Ramana Maharishi, who died in 1950 in Tamil Nadu. And so we're talking about pain, and for me, one of my mantras, I don't mean physical pain, if somebody beat me up or something, it doesn't happen much or at all, but a saying from the Gita, the Bhagavad Gita, the truly wise lament neither for the living nor the dead. And that ultimately, of course, I mustn't lament for myself. That's where the suffering comes from. The Buddha talks about it. Attachment and craving that creates suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And Buddhism is mentioned in the big book, actually, on page XX, along with Hinduism, Islam, Judaism, Catholic and Protestant. a bit of everything really is what I meant. These are the religions that are mentioned in the big book.
Hmm.
So I was trying to find it. I'm a dictionary there, but I can't find it. It's somewhere. I can't pronounce the word, but it's something like Bodhavishta. It's about an enlightened Buddhist person who delays going to Nirvana to help other suffering people. This enlightened person, episode is not suffering, of course, has been one of the sayings of the Buddhism is enlightenment leads to emancipation. And another, the essence of the spirituality of AA, and it's not a Christian fellowship, but it's not anti-Christian either, but is living in the now. And I heard this musician saying in the fellowship, live in the now and know people pleasing. Because I was told when I came into AA first in 85 that it's a selfish program. And I said, I don't want to be selfish. And then a long time later, I found out in the promises, it says, we will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. And as I heard this author, another author like yourself, in AA, in London, over and over again, she used to say, the only authority in AA is the big book. And another saying the Buddha has is, contentment is the greatest wealth. And another saying, which I gave a Krishnamurti book, a present to this person, who was on the fringes of a writer like yourself on the national newspapers. And I wrote on the front of the book, as the Buddha, Gautama Siddhartha, the Buddha said, every morning you are reborn, and what you do today matters most. And it doesn't say what you do today only matters. It says what you do today matters most. And that brings the whole thing into the present tense. If a moment is too long for you, try one day at a time, or moment to moment, which is better than moment to moment. That's what Krishnamurti says, because after a moment, what comes but another moment. But I haven't had a drink or a drug this century. It took me a while to get the message, and I do take medication though. This woman drove me home. I'll finish with this. This woman drove me home from a meeting one night back in the 80s. And she said, we're like crabs without shells. In other words, we're super sensitive. We could do it with a thick skin, like. We're like crabs without shells. So I take medication because they said I was bipolar. It was drug-induced. And you mentioned ayahuasca, if I pronounce the word right. Some people consider that now avenues to God. In the big book, it says, sometimes slowly, sometimes quickly. They will always materialize if you work for them. So that's what I latch on to, instead of resorting to a joint, which I haven't for about 24 years. Instead of resorting to a joint, I try and concentrate on sometimes slowly, sometimes quickly. They will always materialize. You know what I mean? So it'll happen. Revelations can come fast or they can take years. But be patient. Be patient. Thanks very much, Kevin.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. Well, what do you think, Jim?
This feels great. Did you have anything else you wanted to add, Kevin? That was fantastic, the whole meeting.
Well, I guess I will, since there's a little space, just to say that if, you know, just as with recovery, if we want a meditation practice that is really transformative, we have to put in the work. And I think a lot of times, I mean, this is the symptom of addiction, that we want immediate results, just as he was talking about, sometimes slowly, that we want to be fixed, and that we want magic. And I think sometimes people come to spirituality wanting magic. If I find the special mantra or the special, you know, teacher or the special teaching, that then it'll all be fixed. I won't have to do anything. And my experience is that it's the slow and steady. It's the work. It's the showing up one day at a time. It's the sitting down on your cushion or your chair, trying to follow your breath, trying to be present when you don't want to do it, when it doesn't seem like anything's happening, when it seems like you're just wasting your time. It's that brings about the real change and growth. And, you know, so I really encourage people to pursue a particularly a meditation practice in a serious way. If they want what that can give.
Yeah. Oh, that was lovely. That's perfect. I see Tom's got his hand up. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Jim. Hi, Kevin.
Hello.
When I was about maybe 2 or 3 years sober, I joined a Buddhist in Cork. And I think, you know, I really learned a lot from it. I learned about being present. I kind of found a connection deep within myself, you know, because I struggle with the higher power. I also play music like you. I think there's a huge similarity between, you know, being present and studying music. You know, you get really zoned in. But when I used to go to the meetings when I was involved in, you know, I used to practice a lot, but then I found myself falling asleep a lot, and it used to get very embarrassing, you know. So I just wonder, have you any ideas, you know, about that?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I mean, so one of the things that's important in meditation is developing what I'd call an energetic balance between being relaxed but still being awake and alert. And so typically we go to one extreme or the other, to restlessness and, you know, agitation, where we can't sit still or our mind won't stop spinning, or else we're, you know, falling asleep or getting dull. The mind is getting very dull. And so when we start to get relaxed, which is kind of what we're trying to do, if we don't have enough energy to balance that, then we fall asleep. So first of all, the fact that you're falling asleep is a good sign in a way, because it shows that you're getting relaxed, which is a really important thing. Because when I say relaxed, I also mean getting calm, and we could say concentrated. So it's a matter then of trying to just have enough energy to stay awake in that calm state. So one thing you can do is simply open your eyes and meditate with your eyes open. Another thing you could do is make sure that you're sitting upright in a strong posture, because if you're too relaxed, if you're sitting on a couch and you're just sort of laying back on the pillows, you know, you just kind of drift off. So that's why people sit with their legs crossed on a, you know, on a hard cushion. It's partly to keep themselves awake. So sitting upright, sitting with the eyes open. Also, pick a time of day when you tend to be awake. You know, I can't meditate much after dinner. In the evening, I can watch TV and stay awake, but if I meditate, I conk out. So I meditate in the morning, sometimes in the, you know, before dinner, but so all of those things. But fundamentally, we just have to, this is why I was talking about, just keep going. Like, if you just keep practicing, if you just keep trying to be mindful, eventually that energy will balance itself. So if you give up, nothing's going to change, right? Fundamental principle of life. If you just keep showing up, eventually that mindfulness has this quality where it balances energy. If we can just keep, so you can actually be mindful of sleepiness, like, oh, okay, my head feels really heavy. Oh, my eyes feel really, you know, heavy. Okay, what does it feel like to be sleepy? Oh, it feels like this. It feels like I'm a dreamy. And you're just being mindful. So that mindfulness, that attention itself, will tend to counterbalance the sleepiness, because one of the causes of sleepiness is boredom, or, you know, lack of interest. So, you know, you're meditating on the breath. It's like the breath is kind of boring. You know, how can you get interested in your breath so that you'll wake up? We'll start to remember that. If you stop breathing, that's going to be a real problem. So maybe that'll make you more interested in your breath. Like, oh, every one of these breaths is required for me to stay alive. So what's going on? Let me see what it's like to breathe. This is life right here. I'm observing. Oh, this each breath is full of a whole range of sensations. Each one is unique. So bringing that interest in an engagement can help. But to me, it's really about just stick with it, because I can go for months where every time I meditate, I fall asleep. But I nod off, then I pull myself back up, because I sit for a period of time, whether I'm falling asleep or not. I've got my clock there. I'm going to sit for 45 minutes, even if I'm falling asleep half the time. I'll just keep snapping awake and just stick with it. Eventually, you get through it. So don't give up. It's my message.
Yeah, but I wasn't talking about practicing at home. It was sitting with a group. You know, I used to get embarrassed and I would just nod off, you know. And
but that's just your ego.
Get really being, eyes.
Being embarrassed is just your ego. Screw yeah. that. Like, that's too bad, you know. Like, I've sat in the front of 30 people who are teaching meditation and fallen asleep right in front of them. You know, it's good. It's good for you to be embarrassed. It's like, oh, look, I'm attached to people thinking that I'm meditating well. You know, okay. You know, that, you know, if one of our goals is humility, that's a good way to learn it. You know, oh, okay. I have weaknesses as a meditator.
Oh, thanks. I'm still Jeb, of course. You just, when you were talking about the balance there between the alert, the relaxation and the alertness, I'm reminded, you know, I've tried to incorporate a lot of different practices into my 12-step practice, which is the outline for everything I do. And one of the things that I've become aware of is the importance of learning how to activate the parasympathetic nervous system so that I'm not always operating in the sympathetic nervous system, which is that very hyper alert system, and it brings about my fright, flight, you know, freeze responses. But one of my goals is to, you know, when I do feel tension rising, is, you know, Today I do the exercises that activate the vagus nerve, and I go into that relaxed and comfortable and safe place. But my goal is to find a way that they can function together, and it's sort of the thing about like the left brain and right brain, a brain functioning together, but it's the sympathetic and nervous and parasympathetic nervous systems working together. That felt sort of implied in your approach to meditation. But the other piece that I think it comes across in your share is that you're not judging yourself or condemning yourself for slipping into the sleep sort of thing
right.
in that
right.
part of it, because those relaxations are good escapes from the stuff that raises the cortisol level and shortens our lives. So that's yeah. just another thing. And so thanks again for everything, Kevin.
You bet. So for those who can't get enough of Kevin, tomorrow morning at the same time, I'm going to be on the Buddhist Recovery Network Academy. So I put that link in the, and I'm going to talk about long enduring mind, whatever that means. I'll discover tomorrow morning.
Beautiful. Thank you very much, Kevin, for being here and sharing today and sharing a little bit about your journey with us and your thoughts, and everyone for participating, and everyone for being here. It was